to make just one real quick comment for the benefit of Joanne and anybody else who is concerned about the dams that she was talking about. There was, for a long time, real serious consideration being given in the Soviet Union to damming and diverting the Ob and Denisov rivers. And this was especially, it came to a peak in the late 70s, but I think it was 1981 they finally decided to shelve that project because ecological concerns had been raised inside the country. So that they did not go forward with that the particular project that she was referring to, fortunately. Now, I was very intensely involved with what Tom Bearden was discussing, and I guess that's probably all I'm going to have time to get into tonight. First of all, you brought up something which you referred to as electrogravitational waves.
That's what a theta wave is.
Yeah, that's the first time that I've heard you refer to it with that nomenclature. And I'm wondering, is that your term, or has it been characterized by anybody else?
Well, in the 60s, as you know, a lot of people were calling it electrogravitics.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to get at it, but they never got into the zero approach. And so they were trying to really bombard things with a lot of very high voltages and things like that. Some of the research there went classified and then later seemed to just sort of died out. But they called it electrogravitics. It came to be the thing that they called it. And so rather than revive that term, which had just fallen into disrepute, I use the term electrogravitation, because what you're really doing is you're tying electromagnetism and gravitation together like Kaluza did in his theory.
I'm not familiar with Kaluza.
Okay, Kaluza unified electromagnetics and gravitation in 1921. His paper was recommended for publication by Einstein. And what he did is he added one more dimension, so a spatial dimension, so that you had four spatial dimensions and one time dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And in this five-dimensional model, you didn't have a separate electromagnetics and a separate gravitation. You just had gravitation, but it was five-dimensional gravitation. And what we see as electromagnetics, the electromagnetic force fields, are the bleed-off of a five-dimensional gravitational potential in the fifth dimension. In other words, look at it like, to put it in country boy language, you've got this crazy pressure in five dimensions, or stress, that we call a five-dimensional gravity potential. And it always loves to bleed off in electromagnetics in the fifth dimension. It slides around our world so that we see it as photons and electromagnetic energy. But if you block that slide so it can't slide around that way, you force it to bleed off into the other dimensions, the other three dimensions. In other words, it becomes normal gravitational energy at that point. And to show you the kind of amplification you can get, between two electrons, the electric field is normally on the order of 10 to the 42 times as strong as the gravitational field. So the stress between them, the 5G gravity potential, is almost all bleeding off as electric field. Very little of it is bleeding off as gravitational attraction between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were able to go into that between those two electrons and block that bleed off in the fifth dimension and cause it all to bleed off as gravity, then the gravitational attraction between those two electrons would go up on the order of 10 to the 42 times as strong as it is now. Without normal circuits, you aren't going to get the full thing, of course, but if you got a millionth of a percent, you know, effect, you would have enormous amplification. And that's why the scalar electromagnetics offers such a tremendous potential, because that's exactly what you do. When you oppose two force fields, putting it in the Kaluza type of model, one of those force fields represents a bleed off in one direction, a bleed out of the potential, the other represents a bleed back in, and so the potential is not able to decrease by blowing out in the fifth dimension. You force it to blow out in the four dimensions, the normal, everyday, ordinary world, as gravitational energy. And so you have just, when you make a zero, which is what you do when you sum those two together like that, the electromagnetics, what you've really done is turned it into gravitational field energy.
Hmm.
And you've got yourself a real nice amplification factor if you get it doing it very well. You get a pretty good zero.
Hmm.
Did you understand that, Craig?
Yeah, I followed that.
You get five stars.
I'm curious now, how does this relate to the way we understand, for instance, the way the sun produces its energy through nuclear fusion, and we see, you know, the equation E equals mc squared, the mass is being converted to energy. Wouldn't there be a discrepancy if there's also scalar energy being produced?
No, because normally we don't go around doing that. We only measure half of everything anyway. I'm glad you brought the question up because it's something I want to say on this program. Take Newton's law. Every action is opposite and equal reaction. Okay? What that really says, you have a system of something, a particle or whatever. You bring in a system of something else, could even be a photon, and you work on that system. Well, the system works back on you. So if you're expending energy on that system, it's expending the identical amount of energy back on you. And that's true even in statics, because if we believe quantum mechanics, there isn't anything static. There's something working like mad in the vacuum anytime you have a static force, a so-called static force in the macro world. So if you look at those two forces, while Newton's law applies, while you're working on a system and it's working back on you, if you immediately draw a circle around that, you have a vector zero. And that is an artificial potential. It's like a pressure in the gas, you know, where the molecules are going every which way. But you can use that pressure in any direction. You can bleed it off in any direction. So if you grab that thing, John was calling this capturing the surface charge, and that's the way he made that first motor. If you capture that moment when that opposition is going on, it does occur in a finite time. It cannot occur just instantly and be gone. It can occur very fast, but it is finite. If you capture that thing as a potential, you can bleed it off in any direction, you can use it, and guess what? You've got at least twice the energy in there. Even in considering the vacuum to stay linear, you still have twice the energy in there that you had in the amount you were putting in. So if you believe Newton's third law and you believe quantum mechanics, and you will use the artificial potential approach, you can always get more energy out than you put in anyway. T. Henry Morley said, if you really understood what back EMF was and you'd capture and use it, you could do what I'm doing. And John was calling it capturing the surface charge. John was hitting the
back. Hey, Tom, we're about to lose your back EMF. Could you speak up just a little bit there?
Yes, I think our phone is acting up. I'm speaking right in the phone.
Okay.
John was hitting the battery, and in that very instant that he hit the battery, and before the ions that in the battery that were being opposed by the spike, before they could slow down, they kept bearing forward. You had two forces opposing each other electromagnetically, and the momentum of the ions carrying it on in and squeezing that pressure even higher. And then you reach in, John would switch in and capture that pressure and apply it to the coil, which charged instantly. By the way, a coil never charges with magnetic field. That's nonsense.
Right.
It charges with gravitational field. When it discharges its magnetic field, it charges as gravitational field. You're still in five dimensions, and then if you let it discharge in a normal fashion, you get normal old garden variety magnetic field, and that drives your motor. And that's the secret of that first motor, and I have John's permission to say this on the air.
That's right. Tom?
Yes?
Also, you know, since these two guys tonight have shared this information, and also Ron, I'm going to make available those tapes on all the motors I worked on.
Beautiful.
Which do show conventional measurements.
It's been highly classified until now.
Well, but now's the time. There's only so much time, Tom, left in which our society has to pull itself out of its hole.
That's fine, John. Set a nominal price on them so you can continue.
That's right. Now, there's a lot of research work in these things, and there's a lot of research in making this technology available, but I don't want to keep it back from the people.
That's right.
Well, now, if somebody wants those tapes, which you have let me be privy to, they are fascinating.
They're going to get them from Bedini Electronics at our P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 769, San Fernando, California, 91341. And our phone number is area code 818-367-7762. And we'll make the tuners available to the people. We'll make the interferometers available to the people at a very reasonable price so that they can get into this and try to understand what we're doing.
What we're doing, I think, is one of the most significant things in the world because we're seeing a grassroots movement in science.
Well, it's about...
Rather than leaving it up to the politicians and the large universities and corporations, and hopefully they'll drag themselves along one of these
days. But, of course, also, Tom, I think you're in agreement with this, Ron Cole has done numerous amounts of work on these motors.
Yes, indeed.
All right? And Ron has proven, without a shadow of a doubt, a little bitty generator driving a motor five times its size.
That's correct.
And speeding up while doing it.
That's Did you correct. Do that, Ron? Are you still there, Ron? Oh, Ron, you're there. I just didn't have you punched in. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, I'm here now. Yes, I have done what John mentioned.
But tell him, Ron. Tell him about the little bitty wires. And, you see, I want to throw this into the program because the motor that they are looking at is what our science calls believing.
Okay, well, let me give an explanation of the itty bitty wires, as you mentioned.
Can you hold on that explanation, Ron?
Yes, I can.
You understand this as much as anybody, but I have to take a little break here before we get to the little bitty wires, smaller than your hair, that shouldn't do what they're doing.
All right.
Isn't that true?
Yes, that's true.
All right. Hang in there. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind on KABC. There's here.
Okay. I try to give an illustration of this in a somewhat simplex form so some listeners can understand. In electrical flow, basic circuits based on conventional engineering design, current and voltage oppose each other. They flow in virtually opposite directions. And this goes back to as far as Steinmetz, basic engineering books still taught in the college today by Mr. Cook and so on and so forth. Point being that the voltage is equivalent to the value or quantity of what is to be used, such as water. Current is how much water do you have? What is the mass of the water? Okay. Well, in electrical circuit, these two factors end up trying to oppose each other. So when you need a greater flow of water in electricity, we would call it a greater flow of current. The wire has to be larger. Otherwise, a tremendous heating will take place due to the restriction of a small wire, or we could call it water-wise, a small pipe. And if you try to force umpteen gallons of water through a tiny pipe, there has to be a tremendous force on the other end to push it through the tiny pipe. If it's a large pipe, it takes very little force to push the same amount of displacement of water through a given time period. Okay, now, when I get into a scalar signal that's sent down a wire, voltage and current flow in the same direction simultaneously. They're coherent with each other. Okay, if you're flowing at the speed of light coherently in the same direction, there's no way heating can be created. A wire can be the size of a person's human hair.
It usually is, don't it?
Exactly. Now, you can, your whole house could be wired up with number 40 wire rather than number 12.
If you can find it.
Exactly.
And Ron, tell him if you touch the two wires together, the machine just speeds away, right?
Exactly.
And you can hold those naked wires and nothing happens to your fingers.
So no little kid could stick his finger in the socket and get killed.
Exactly. Now, let me explain something. Approximately a little over a year ago, about a year and a half ago now, I was in John's lab over there, and he had fired off a 1,500-watt load with two pieces of number 42 wire off his generator.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I thought he was firing it off with one piece of wire. The other one was laying on a little piece of carpet. I couldn't see it because it wasn't too well lit at the time.
It's very small, smaller than your hair.
And he said, put your hand on this one, the one I could see, and I did. And I couldn't believe it. There's no way you can carry 1,500 watts through a piece of number 42 wire. And these wires were at least 3 to 4 feet long. And here was a quartz heating element glowing full bore. So John says, let me show you this one. And so he takes the two little wires off the end of the generator, connects them onto a normal AC plug, plugs them into a normal receptacle from the Edison Company or whoever, and they immediately accelerated themselves. Okay.
Bad electricity.
Now, does that tell you what scalar is? Something is traveling in the same direction at an infinite velocity. Does not need a big pipe. That makes sense.
Greg, did that help you?
Well, actually, it got a little bit off the subject. So could I try to get a brief answer from Tom on what I had raised?
Okay, go ahead.
Ask him to repeat the question. Then.
Repeat it again.
Yeah,
Greg.
I will. I was very interested in what was just being discussed. But you had referred to the fact that the sun itself, or any star for that matter, of course, is in fact generating scalar or energy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how this relates to the way we normally understand the production of energy by a stellar object.
It spins our planet, Craig.
Excuse me?
It spins our planet around.
You got 30 seconds to answer the question.
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, we usually explain in terms of nuclear fusion with the E equals MC squared and the energy's deriving from mass. Now, is there a discrepancy here?
No, it fuels all of that in addition, but it does produce heat completely separately from that. But it certainly fuels all the radioactivity and everything else. It's in equilibrium.
Is there a conversion of mass into energy?
Yes, there's no problem with that. In fact, you can go one step further. By energy, if you mean ordinary electromagnetic energy, you can go further into gravitational field energy, in which case it's really scalar electromagnetic.
You know what, Tom? We're going to have to go one step further at another time. We just ran out of it. Craig, I'm sorry. I wish we'd have got to you earlier. Your questions are always very penetrating, and I appreciate you hanging on the line as long as you did. And Bill and Ray, thank you so much for the research that you've done to show that this is happening. And Ron Cole, you too. How very nice that you guys are getting behind John Bedini and Tom Bearden with what they're doing. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's run-through of Weather Wars Update and a look at the new world that we'll live in, and it's the world of the scalar. We'll see you next week. I'm Bill Jenkins.